This week on Required Reading, we talk about A River Runs Through It, a touching novella about the prodigal son, perhaps, about fishing, definitely about fishing, about relationships between families with brothers and fathers, a touching story. I will throw out this immediately. I recommend it. It's short. Go ahead and listen to it now. We appreciate you, really, truly. I know this year has been kind of messy with our scheduling, but we promise we're working on a way to make it more punctual. In the meantime, follow Michael C. Carroll on Instagram and review us wherever you get us. We appreciate it. Thanks, everyone. I have no idea how long this episode will be because this story's like 100 pages. But also, you know, sometimes we get into it.
Yeah, we could talk about it for, feels like forever.
Welcome to Required Reading. We will talk a little bit about some, I guess, more recent fiction. We're doing today Norm MacLean's timeless tale of River Runs Through It, a short story-ish story. That is semi-autobiographical, and I guess we'll get into that a little bit. But this week we're talking about the Serenity of Montana and fishing and the process of fly fishing and a story about family. It's a tight little, I don't know, when I was talking to Mike, I said that this was a book about processes, and I would usually hate that. But somehow it seems so serene and transcendent, and it's remarkable.
Yeah, I almost feel like we could start right there in trying to describe what it was that we just read. And I, after finishing up my reading of it, and this was the first time I had read it, I wanted to talk with people about it. So I'm very excited to be able to sit down with you guys and hear what you guys have to say. But I was trying to describe it to some of the other people in my life that I had kind of sent it over to. I know that my father-in-law is a big-time fisherman, and so I wanted him to read it. So in trying to describe it to him and then also to my brother, who does some hunting and does some fishing as well, I described it as a story about fly fishing, but then also about family. And that's the best way that I could describe it. But it's been one of those stories that that I think from talking with you guys, you would agree with this. It kind of sticks with you. And it's kind of hard to pin down exactly what it is that's really sticking with me about it. But it's definitely been one that I can't wait to talk with you guys about.
I do realize it's been a while since we're out of shape. So I'm your host, Nick Hoffman, and on panel we have
Mike Carroll
and
Mike Burns. Good to be back. I missed the red wall one, so yeah. Glad to be back with you guys.
So, Mr. Burns, then why don't you start us off because you suggested this. So,
yes,
what brought you to it?
I'm trying to think back. I know the movie, which is Robert Redford.
The other one.
The other guy. Butch or Sundance. That came out in 92, I think, 92, 93. Mm-hmm. And so that was on my radar. But I want to say I knew of the story first, but I don't think I read it, just sort of knew of it somehow. And then the movie, which you haven't seen yet, Mike.
No, I haven't.
Is beautiful, and I would highly recommend. And it's true to the book, I would say. Inspired me to go read the story, and then it was just so... It's a story about family. It's and fishing, but I think the quality of writing is just so great that it literally just like I'm not a good fisherman. I enjoy standing on the shore and drinking a beer or whatever, but this just carries you along like the water, and the prose just flows so smoothly and so beautifully. And the end, I mean, we'll get to the last paragraph, but you just put it down and go, oh my God, like this guy can write. This is incredible. Mm-hmm. So I think. Maybe that's what's sticking with me, or that's what's stuck with me over the years. And then rereading it, I forgot how much of it really is a love letter to his brother, essentially, which definitely comes across in the film, but more so, I think, on the page. So,
yeah. When I was done making my way through it, I was thinking about how this could possibly be a second person story. Like there's the saying in literature that there's no such thing as like a second person story, and that Gatsby kind of like comes a little bit close to that. It's a story more about Gatsby than it is about Nick. And I was kind of thinking that there are some similarities here with this being a story so much. It's like an homage or kind of in honor. It's like an ode to Paul almost. And you can see that in the writing. It's so beautiful. And that word beautiful means so much in this story. And I think that it's certainly true to fact. I think that it's beautiful writing. And I think that dynamic that these brothers have is beautiful too. And I think that's in retrospect, I think that's kind of been my takeaway too, is the beautiful relationship between the narrator and Paul.
No, go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say, it's funny you bring it up as Gatsby, because the last paragraph reminded me of F. Scott Fitzgerald kind of breakdown at the end of Gatsby, where we have something that it almost feels like it's from a different book, but it summarizes Gatsby, of course. But there's that kind of moment where there is a philosophy to life. Perhaps it's not attainable, but understandable. Like, because this is a very personal story, which you get the feeling, even though he calls it semi-fiction, semi-autobiography, that this really – the emotions are real.
Yeah.
We're reading Tim O'Brien now in class. It's the fiction sometimes is truer than nonfiction.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I heard an interview – I stumbled across an interview with Studs Terkel and Norman MacLean, which is incredible. Go out there and find it. But in it, MacLean is talking about that beauty that – there's a collect this story, and then there's a story about a logger, and then there's a story about a gambler guy that was originally published together, and it's not in my edition here. But he said, like, there was something beautiful about all three, like something beautiful about the way his brother would fish, mm-hmm. like that's an art, and something beautiful about this other Sawyer, this guy who was on the other end of a two-handled log. Blade mm-hmm. cutting trees when Norman MacLean was serving in the log service or the forest service. And so I think he's trying to capture, he says as much, he's trying to capture that beauty in his prose. And
yeah.
He certainly does.
I think you nailed it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The art of fly fishing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think where we should start, perhaps, we will talk about the end, but I think the first paragraph is almost
yes.
as good.
Yeah, for sure.
In our family, there's no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of the great trout rivers of western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John, the favorite, was the dry fly fisherman.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
It's remarkable. Mm-hmm. And so immediately we get a little bit about the family. Immediately we get a little bit about religion. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a Protestant work, and they bring up the kind of fiery Irishness, the Celticness, the Presbyterianness of
Scots.
It all.
Scottish.
Scottish, yeah.
Don't say Irish to him.
No, please. Yeah. We'll get letters. Mm-hmm. Dearest sir, I don't know who writes into a book podcast. I imagine it's highly literate.
I'll see it in the DMs, I'm sure.
It's written long form.
Yeah.
But no, it's just remarkable the way that it kind of goes. A Scot and a Presbyterian, my father, believed by nature, was a mess and fallen from its original state of grace. Yeah. We get this because it's a prodigal son story, and it's so good.
Yeah. You know, I'm just like sitting over here listening, and I'm like, Nick, when are you going to stop? Because you could just go from that sentence right into the next, mm-hmm. right into the next.
Yep.
And it's just the way that the story flows, it really is like a river, not to use the kind of metaphor that's staring us right in the face, but it really flows in and out of these anecdotes and these stories about Paul that are as much celebratory as they are riddled with grief and regret. And that kind of dichotomy is, I think, kind of at the heart of this story. All of those moments where he wishes that he could have done something or knew what it is that he could have done. And there are so many moments that are in the car. I'm thinking early on about when Paul is talking about the drunk driving arrest that he had, and just like wanting to be able to step in and either offer kind of like a hand to help or to not make light of the situation and to kind of like be able to extend that olive branch towards his brother that he loves so much, and he doesn't do it, and then it makes, I think, the ending of the story, not that we're really spoiling it, I guess, but Paul does end up, it's kind of all about Paul's death, and you get that foreshadowed a number of times throughout these fishing trips that they're on about that was the last time that I ever went fly fishing with my brother, and that was the last time that the three of us, meaning the narrator, Norman, and Paul and their father were ever together. You get all of these kind of like foreshadowing moments that you know that there's going to be a loss that's going to end up taking place. And the ending of the story just brings that grief so close to home in this notion that both it's not just the narrator, it's not just Norman, it's also the father who wishes that they could have known so that they could have done something or said something. And ultimately that question is never really either verbalized or certainly not answered, of like, could we have done anything more? And it kind of just like sits there like a lead balloon, that it doesn't get an answer. And it's kind of tragic in that way, you know?
Yeah, there's that scene sort of towards the end where they're talking about like, how do we help Paul, or what do we do? And they sort of have this meditation. It's as the narrator and his father. This is his father saying, help is giving part of yourself to somebody who comes to accept it willingly and needs it badly. But they don't know that exactly, like they can tell Paul is, but they don't know what to do or how to help. And so they ultimately decide, and the narrator says, the father says, Lord, we are willing to help, Lord, but what if anything is needed?
Yeah.
And then Norman says, well, I still know how to fish. And mm-hmm. so that's what they do, and they go fish, and that's all they can do. Just, mm-hmm. But just that idea of spending time together or, mm-hmm. or being together. And I think it's really interesting that all three of us have all brothers as siblings, yeah. right? And so yeah. this is very much sort of a father-son-brother relationship mm-hmm. in this. And maybe that's why that resonated with us too. Because mm-hmm. I certainly, you know, as I'm reading this, I think of my own brother and our relationship and with our father. And so, yeah, it's all
I think
in
it's
there.
Impossible not to,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And even in those lines when they're fishing and they're talking about, like, that notion of competition, right? Yeah. In like, who's catching more fish. And there's the kind of the paragraph very early on when they're talking about Norman, who went off to work for the U.S. Forest Service, and Paul stayed back and was a lifeguard. And so he spent his evening still fishing. And so you have kind of like the brother that ends up surpassing the other brother right. in the skill set of fly fishing, if nowhere else. And so I was just reminded of kind of that notion of competition that's also love at the same time. I'm thinking about my brother and I like playing like these stupid college NCAA video games, like college football NCAA, and like getting into these not like physical fights, but into these games that are as much competition as they are kind of like being around one another. And those like silly, totally tangential moments in like that relationship between myself and my brother are kind of, they share similarities with the relationship of Norman and Paul. And it's one of those things where I do think, Mike, that you're right. I think that there are these similarities. And now even it's really funny, because my brother, before we had even started reading this for the podcast, had texted me, because he does quite a bit of hunting and some fishing up north. And he was texting me saying, Mike, I want to get you up here so we can get you out on the lake and we can go fishing together. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where it's just like, man, it's just so that he just does such an amazing job of explaining that brotherly dynamic, that it's not like anything that I've ever seen written before. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what's sticking with me so much.
Well, and I guess to wit, I also like how the parents are depicted as kind of trying to split the difference between the two brothers. You mm-hmm. know, it is a prodigal son story, of course. You know, the one brother leaves and comes back. The other one is more regular and stable mm-hmm. and solid. But the dialogue that stuck with me is near the end. It's like in the last third. But they are looking at the rocks, and he says to his father, We stopped and peered out of the bag. I asked my father, do you remember when we picked up a lot of red and green rocks there to build our fireplace? Some were mudstones with ripples on them. Some had raindrops on them, he said, his imagination always stirred by the thought that he was standing in ancient rain spattering on mud before they became rocks. Nearly a billion years ago, I said, knowing what he was thinking. He paused. He had given up the belief that God had created all there was, including the Blackfoot River, on a six-day work schedule. But he didn't believe that the job so taxed God's powers that it took him forever to complete. Nearly half a billion years, he said, as his contribution to the recoiling science and religion. Reconciling science and religion. I just love that idea that 6 days, a billion years, what's half? Half a billion years, right? Like it's a perfect average. It's a summation of everything. And it's there's something about the minister, the reverend, at the heart of this family that on one hand makes it perhaps tragic, but he never looks at his son as I failed you morally. Which is nice. It rounds out the story, I think. So I don't know. Do you guys want to try to go through the story?
I've got a kind of like a jotting down of it. I think we've seen success with me just kind of like going through a decent enough chunk of it, and then we'll kind of stop and chat about what it is that we see.
Okay.
So I have written down the first sentence that in our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing, and that just tees up the rest of this story. And I love that line so much. But anyways, we kind of get into very early on that this is going to be a story about the life of Paul, and for the good, bad, and the ugly too, right? It's going to be, you get that notion of alcohol and gambling and fighting, but at the center of it all is this art of fly fishing that we're going to be experiencing as well. The Paul ends up coming back home. The timing of this, I was trying to kind of like review it for the podcast, but does Neil and Paul both come back at the same time at the start of the story? I know that Neil, a character that we haven't talked about, is the like brother-in-law of Norman,
right.
And they're regardless of the timing. Neil is the brother-in-law of Norman, and they're in Wolf Creek. Is that right? They're in Wolf Creek.
That's where his wife is from. Norman's wife,
because it's
from,
where his wife is from, and so his brother-in-law is kind of like in town, and his brother Paul is in town too, and they are going to be doing some fishing. We get the. Let's just go to where Norman and Paul kind of like in their early years they had that one.
Can
fight
I stop
with,
you for a second? Because this is making me think. I know I forget it otherwise, but in that interview with McLean, and I don't think it's in the book, he talks about how he could not stand Neil as a person in real life, and he says it's hard to look at someone with your wife's face who you hate. And
yeah,
so, that was a great line. So yeah. Anyway, just
no, no,
up,
no.
So,
I think that's the character of Neil is such an interesting character in this story too, and we haven't even talked about Neil, nor have we really talked about the dynamics with the women that are in this story too. The mother and Norman's wife. I think what's her name? No, I have it jotted down. Jesse is the wife of Norman, and that dynamic between them, where it's like we love our family members even when they can be terrible, even when they are awful, and all of the women in the family continue to kind of like bring it back to Norman, and I feel bad for Norman in a lot of those instances where it's like he's trying to do the right thing, he turns in early, and then he gets in trouble from his wife because he wasn't paying close enough attention to another grown man, and like I feel bad for Norman in a lot of the scenes that we see. But anyways, early on in their childhood, they do have Paul and Norman one fight in which their mother ends up falling down, and they vow that they're never going to kind of like fight again. And I love that passage too, because it shows the while his mother and Jesse aren't as present during the actual fly fishing episodes that are here, they're still very present in they're still kind of like that motherly, maternal female component to this story that is kind of nurturing at the same time as well. But Norman in his early years goes off to work for the U.S. Forest Service, leaving Paul to lifeguard and be fly fishing at home. I know I mentioned that already. But when Norman married Jesse, he moved to Wolf Creek. Paul ended up going to Helena, and then it's when Paul comes back from Helena to visit with the family, that we start to get, as they're going up for this fishing trip that they're taking, Paul talking about a drunk driving accident that he had gotten into, that he was needing to pay like an inordinate fine for. And it was one of the first moments that Norman has that moment in the car as they're about to go on this fishing trip, where he doesn't really know what to say. And his brother, Paul, makes a joke about it, but he doesn't really know how to react to it. And we get one of those first moments of Norman kind of being in this stuck position where he wants to say something to this brother that he loves to try and help him out, and he doesn't really know what to say. But Paul ends up getting into, over the course of that, they have that first fishing trip, and then Paul gets into a fight over a Native American girl that he is with, and ends up going to jail. And so Norman ends up needing to come and bail him out. And after the kind of aftermath of this night of drinking out, Neil has a hangover, and they're getting ready to go up for this trip up to Elkhorn. And that's going to be kind of the I guess we'll stop there. That's probably roughly a third through the kind of the narration of the start of the story.
So I want to point out just something that I kind of brought up earlier, which is the process part of this. It's so much about fly fishing, of course, and we mentioned that, but over and over, he describes the process of how to find the right fishing hole, how to properly cast. And to me, that adds this, it tells us his inner workings. There's a system of how things are right and how things are wrong. And the brother, somehow, using the same rules, lives a completely different life, which is the metaphor of what's going on, you know. So we start, I'm just literally, I think, on the second page, at least in my version, it's a PDF version. After he buttoned his glove, he would hold his rod straight in front of him where it trembled with the beating of his heart. Although it was 8.5 feet long, it weighed only 4.5 ounces. It was made of split bamboo cane from far off Bay of Tonkin. It was wrapped with red and blue silk thread, and the wrappings were carefully spaced to make the delicate rod powerful, but not so stiff it could not tremble. It was always called a rod. If someone called it a pole, my father would look at him as a sergeant in the U.S. Marines would look at a recruit who had just called a rifle a gun. Like, there's just something so perfect about it. Mm-hmm. And then the father being the minister. Well, until a man is redeemed, he will always take the fly rod too far back, just as natural as a man overswings an axe or a golf club and it loses all the power somewhere in the air. Only with a rod, it's worse. And like, there's just everything has a reason. As if just like if you're talking to an artisan or a master or something, everything has a specific purpose. And that's why this story is interesting, because these two brothers are raised with the same set of rules and they end up with very different lives. It's just it's awesome.
The number of times that they like talk down like bait fishermen or real fishermen too, I thought was so great too, that like they're in this, that they've been brought up to like basically worship this art of fly fishing, and you can tell that it's something that has given so much to them. And then that animosity that they share for down lines and for bait fishing and for reel fishing is just, I think it's so it's so cool, and it makes them members of a very exclusive club, you know, and they take tremendous amount of pride. And I guess that's what I'll say, is that it shows the amount of pride that they have in this art of fly fishing, that they kind of talk about it the way that they do, as this religion, as this art form that they get to take part in.
Yeah. Just you reminded me, so I looked up the line. But eventually he introduced us to the literature on the subject. He always tried to say something stylish as he unbuttoned the glove on his casting hand. Isaac Walton, he told us when my brother was 13 or 14, is not a respectable writer. He was an Episcopalian and a bait fisherman.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Like, yeah.
Because they are Presbyterians and they are fly fishermen, and damn it, they are proud of that fact.
Yeah.
It's just, there's something so matter of fact about that that is wonderful.
Yeah, he was a bait fisherman. Yeah.
Yeah, I think embedded in that is like in Norman's own terms, like what it means to be a man, right? And so a man is a fly fisherman. A man, you know, observes these certain rituals or understands these certain powers or appreciates these certain things. So it's very masculine. I don't know if I've ever talked to a female about this book and what their take on it would be.
Yeah.
Because it's so male-centered, even though the women are in the background and sort of containing this male energy, I guess. But, I don't know. It's just so beautiful. What else, Mike?
Yeah, so we can kind of continue along into this fishing trip that they're doing up at Elkhorn. Paul and Norman go fishing, and they leave Neil again. They leave Neil the previous night, like, at the bar so that they can turn in so that they can be ready for their fishing trip the next day. And then they leave him at the, like, on, like, a bank in the river so that they can go and fish. And then they end up coming back. They end up leaving Neil a couple of times over the over the course of their fishing. But in this, I can't remember if this was the one where they. I think they. Can't remember if this is the time that they leave the beers. No, that was the last fishing time. The last trip with Neil is when they leave the beers and they end up getting drank. But they go on this fishing trip. They leave Neil and Norman on the return ends up getting in trouble with Jesse again for leaving his brother-in-law leaving Jesse's brother kind of like out on his own. I know that there's another trip where that ends up happening as well. They leave Neil pretty much every single time, which is, I think, such a moment in the story where it's like it's almost as though they don't want. And from hearing Mike, you talk about the way that McLean was talking about his relationship with Neil, this definitely tracks, but it almost feels as though they didn't want Neil there for this very kind of like brotherly thing that they were doing in this experience of going fly fishing.
He's not a member of the club. Right, he doesn't know the rituals of the fly fishing. Mm-hmm. He's a bait fisherman. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the interview, McLean says that, in the film, Neil is portrayed as a guy that goes to Hollywood to try to make it big and comes back and brags. But in real life, apparently he went to Seattle.
Okay.
And then came back and acted like he was so, you know, cosmopolitan and high above everybody yeah. else that mm-hmm. you know, they didn't want to be around him because he was such a snob, apparently. So.
And I just want to add to your storytelling here. Throughout this whole time, we get stories that well, he's been gambling again,
yeah.
and mm-hmm. you know he owes a lot of money to the people in town, so he needs to be careful.
Drinking nonstop,
and he's yeah. drinking all the time. And like we get the kind of European roughneck, like beer is not really alcohol thing,
yeah.
but he is also drinking liquor all the time, right? Like all, and I mean Neil's drinking too, but like everyone is drinking here, and that's a problem. And obviously, we're building up to the purpose of this at the end, but all of these things are kind of tightly fitting together to show us where the book is going. And it's so subtle, you don't notice it at first until I realized the third time he mentioned that he owed money all over town.
Jumping back, Mike, when you told your father-in-law about it, did he know of it as a fisherman?
So he had. It's funny. I ended up actually listening to it on audiobook on his Audible account. So I was going through and I was trying to find it in audiobook form in like a couple of different apps, and it ended up being on, I pulled it up on my father-in-law's Audible account that I have on my phone, and I was going through and it didn't have an option to buy with credits. It didn't even have zero credits. It just said play. So I think that he at some point had been, he knew about it and he'd been turned onto it, I think, before. And so I hit play on either something that he had started to listen to or hadn't listened to in quite some time. But he had known about it. And I think that he had mentioned knowing about the movie as well. So when I was talking with him about what I said that I wanted for him to read it so that then we could chat about it, he said, like, yes, we could do that. Also, the movie is very good, too. So I think that he's familiar enough with the movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I have nothing to add about the plot at this point. It's so much about it is, I don't know, we're getting different views of the family. So we have the first fishing trip. A lot of it is fishing between the brothers. They need an excuse to hang out. And again, this is family. You don't just hang out with your sibling. Mm-hmm. You need a reason to. And so fishing is often that reason. Mm-hmm. We do have the brother, when he comes back to town, it is very prodigal son. The mom only wants to serve the younger brother and has his favorite food and his favorite jellies.
Choke and cherry jam. You know,
which is just, it's funny. It's very motherly as it goes. But
But yeah, so then the continuation of this fishing trip, it's almost like rinse and repeat, right? We get these fishing trips, and then they abandon Neil, and then the family is upset because they abandoned Neil, and so they're upset again, and then they go fishing, and then they abandon Neil, and then they come back again, right? And so it's kind of cyclical in that way. But they go on. It's after the previous fight with Jesse that he says, like, for the betterment of our marriage and for the betterment of, like, the family, I thought that it would be a good idea to go fishing with Paul. And so they go on another fishing trip, and that's the time, I think, that they don't even know that Neil is coming. Neil and, what was the name, old Rawhide ended up kind of, like, following behind them, and so they ended up getting drunk once again. As they were going fishing, that's when they ended up with these terrible sunburns as they were kind of, like, left drunk on the side while Paul and Norman went fishing. And so, of course, they come back home, and that's the, like, the fight that you get a little bit of the kind of reconciliation between Jesse and Norman there, where it's one of those things where Norman even says, like, he's my family, so it's basically the equivalent of he's my family, so I am forced to love him, but I don't have to like him, or something mm-hmm. along those lines. Yeah. And they have that kind of, once again, an unanswered question where it's like, well, if he comes back, like, are we gonna, like, what's gonna be your reaction? Like, are you gonna take care of him? Are you gonna abandon him again? And it's kind of one of those things that kind of, it's another one of those unanswered questions in this story where it's like, well, we don't really know what it is that we're gonna do with Neil next time he rolls around. But you can tell that there's that kind of, like, family dynamic that's at work there, that they love one another, but they don't have to like one another. And certainly that seems like it's the case for Norman towards Neil more often than not. But this kind of tees up the last fishing trip that they have, which is this trip between the father and Norman and Paul. They go up fishing, and they kind of stop off at the parents' house to pick up their father all along the way. And this is when you're getting a lot of those foreshadowed lines that I talked about before, where they're saying that it was the last time that I ever went fishing with my father and with my brother. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was my first time reading through it. I haven't seen the movie. So I, based off of the gambling and the drinking that Paul had been going through, I kind of figured that was going to be the direction that the tragedy ended up going. But I didn't know. So I didn't know. I was kind of reading on the edge of my seat, or listening rather, because I was doing this one on audiobook, as to what it is that was going to happen. I didn't know if the father-in-law was going to, or if their father was going to end up getting sick on this fishing trip, or what it was that was going to happen. I didn't know where the tragedy, like, the other foot of this tragedy was going to end up falling. And so I was reading, like, very tensely, and I think that the foreshadowing did such an incredible job of that, because it sets up this what's eventually going to be this great tragedy, but it doesn't take place on that fishing trip. And so that fishing trip, in my mind, is what I think about with this story. It's that last fishing trip with the brother and with the father, and they go, and it's this moment of pride for Norman because he's catching way more fish than his brother, who in all accounts is the better fly fisherman, until they get to the end of the fishing trip, and Norman, being exhausted, goes and sits with his father. I think that might even be, Mike, the line that you had talked about before, about, like, well, how can we help him? Can we help him? And they watch Paul fish at the end of this fishing trip, and they watch him reel in this enormous fish. And I had the line up. I'll see if I can pull it up. But that fishing trip with his father and with his brother Paul is definitely kind of, like, the scene that sticks out with me the most in retrospect, because it just is this perfect little episode of just, like, all of the, I think it's when all of the most beautiful prose in the story kind of end up coming together in this kind of reeling, well, not reeling in, how dare they hear me say reeling in, yeah. but the catching of this fish, it's just so remarkable and so well done. So I've got it's the line here. It's at the end of this fishing trip where he and his father are talking, and Norman says, or the narrator says, the man put the wand down, got on his hands and knees in the sand. And there you get kind of like that worshiping, right, of this, of this fly fishing. And like an animal circled another animal and waited. Then the shoulder shot straight out, and my brother stood up, faced us, and with uplifted arm proclaimed himself the victor. Something giant dangled from his fist. Had Romans been watching, they would have thought that what was dangling had a helmet on it. That's his limit, I said to my father. "He is beautiful," my father said. Although my brother had just finished catching his limit in the hole, my father had already fished. And it's that tie-in that it's the same place that his father had just been finished fishing. You would think that notion of competition, right? You get Norman, who had been fishing better than his brother all along, and they're just watching, like, mesmerized as they're watching this artist perform this act of being able to catch this fish. And there's not an ounce of animosity there. There's not an ounce of jealousy, though. Paul was jealous of his brother earlier, threw a rock into the fishing hole to keep him from catching any more fish. Yeah. And you can see that kind of notion of competition that's there. But here you get all the line is so simple. He is beautiful. And that obviously there's the dichotomy there between the fish that has just been caught and also the antecedent of he, I think, clearly being Paul there, where they're just watching this man that they love in catching this fish doing what it is that he loves most, and the artistry of the fisherman is so great. Then the very next paragraph says, "This was the last fish we were ever to see Paul catch. My father and I talked about this moment several times later, and whatever our other feelings, we always felt it fitting that when we saw him catch his last fish, we never saw the fish, but only the artistry of the fisherman." And my gosh, I got goosebumps as I'm reading through that, because it's this like beautiful ending to that fishing trip, and to the way that they see Paul in this story is just so magnificent.
I like the next paragraph, if you don't mind, I'll read it.
Well, that's exactly what I was saying about Nick, right? Like, you could just keep going on and on.
But, while my father was watching my brother, he reached over to pat me, but he missed. So he had to turn his eyes and look for my knee and try again. He must have thought I felt neglected and that he should tell me he was proud of me also, but for other reasons. And so this idea of the father's like, oh, Paul's so good, I need to console my other son.
Yeah.
But Norman's like, they're both just watching the beauty of watching Paul fish.
Gosh,
that
it's so good.
Just like, I don't need that, Dad. We're just witnessing this thing together. It's like in communion of this beautiful actor, this artist at work.
And what an awesome way. It was the way that he described it. And this is when it gets into the Tim O'Brien, right? Of like how much of this is fact, how much of this is actually fiction. Like whether the father actually like missed the knee or not, what he's done is he's used that moment as a way of creating this very complicated relationship between Paul and Norman and their father, and using this really intimate moment in order to explain something so complicated. And he does such an incredible job of it in that moment. I'm glad you read another paragraph there, because I love the complexity that he is able to explain in such a succinct and beautiful image there.
Yeah. And it's so sort of beautiful. I don't know about your relationship with your fathers or your brothers, but a lot of that is just unsaid, right? Mm-hmm. It's just sort of through what you do or just being together in sports or activities or whatever, that you might not say it, but you feel it and you acknowledge it, and then you kind of move on, and then you look back and remember those moments. I think that's – and McLean wrote this when he was 70 years old. So this is obviously like looking back and capturing those moments. But thank God he did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gives me hope. Maybe when I'm 70, I'll be able to write something like that. My goodness.
Same. All of us. Yeah.
And so I guess since we're here, kind of – we'll talk about the end a little bit here. But the part that – you always cheer when they go. They say the title in the text.
Oh my gosh!
But I scrambled up the bank and asked my father. This is him talking to his dad. How many did you get? He goes, "I got all I want." I said, "But how many did you get?" He said, "Four or five." "Are they any good?" He said, "They are beautiful." He was the only man I ever knew who used the word beautiful as a natural form of speech, and I guess I picked up the habit from hanging around him when I was little. "How many did you catch?" he asked. "I caught all I want," I told him. I admitted him asking me how many there was, but he did ask me, "Are they any good?" "They're beautiful," I told him. I sat down. He had been reading the Bible in Greek, because of course he did. "What have you been reading?" I asked. "A good book," he said. It was on the ground on the other side of him, so I would not bother to look over his knees to see it. He said, "A very good book." He then told me, in the part I was reading, it says, "The word was in the beginning," and that's right. I used to think that the water was first, but if you can listen carefully, you will hear that the words are underneath the water. Mm-hmm. perfect. It's absolutely perfect. And this is when they're watching his brother about to catch the last fish. Mm-hmm. And there you get in him not only the preacher but the fisher, right? That's because you're a preacher first and then a fisherman, I told him. If you ask Paul, he will tell you that the words are formed out of water. No, my father said, you're not listening carefully. The water runs over the world, and Paul will tell you the same thing. Where is Paul anyway? He's gone back to the first hole again.
Yeah. Right
there. That's what it is. And so I love the use – something that I think a confident writer does is they don't bother to explain stuff. Mm-hmm. He'll tell you why he's using the right fly, but he doesn't explain what a fly is. Yep. He doesn't explain how it goes together. He just tells you the right way to do things. He even describes the whiskey as an old 3777. No idea what that is, but I trust him.
Yeah.
And so the confidence he puts in his writers, in his characters, is all there. This is a very real conversation because of it. Right? We know everything you need to know about the father because he loves fishing, but he hasn't done it in a while. So he's confused where he put his damn tackle box, right? Yeah. And then here he's reading the Gospels in Greek because even though he's retired, that's not something that ever leaves you.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
I think in like creative writing terms, it's all show and no tell, right? He's just creating this beautiful tapestry.
Yeah.
And for a first-person narrator that is as rich and is as complicated and is as eloquent as Norman is, there's still nothing that is outright said. And I think that that's kind of a like a common kind of trope throughout the story, is that he just creates this beautiful landscape and story. And it isn't like in the scene that we were talking about before with the missing of the knee. It's not as though he needs to go and he needs to dive into that and say, well, my father thought that it was that he needed to like help me out, that my brother was catching more fish than I was. And he doesn't have to go in and explain all of that. He just uses it with all of the with all of the imagery and with the scenes that he's using. It's just so well done. It's just so great.
That's right.
I guess should we get into the ending?
Well, yeah, tease up the end right there, right?
So we catch the last fish, right? He's got his limit, and they're watching him get this fish. The wand went down. He got on his knees, like you said. That's his limit. I said, the father, he is beautiful. My father said, although my brother had just finished catching his limit in the hole where my father had already fished. And so we have this change. The fish isn't beautiful. He is beautiful. There's this moment of purity. And then it just, you can jump right into it, but.
Yeah, well, you kind of can and you can't, because you go from this like fishing, like escapade that they've gone on that is clearly so meaningful to them, and then you jump into, in terms of like the plot of what ends up happening, Paul then is beaten to death and left in an alley, and the family is left to kind of like try and piece together what could have been said and what should have been said, and this tremendous tragedy in the aftermath of it. And it's there's so much that's not spoken in this moment of grief. So it's like you go from such a high with this immaculate fishing story, and then it's immediately brought back down into the grief that that Norman and his father are experiencing. And I'll see if I can find the line. So this is the father and the Norman kind of talking, and it's talking about the tragedy of Paul being killed and left in the alley. And Norman says, the police don't know, I said. But do you? He asked, and I felt the implication. I've said I've told you all I know. If you push me far enough, all I really know is that he was a fine fisherman. You know more than that, my father said. He was beautiful. Yes, I said. He was beautiful. He should have been. You taught him. My father looked at me for a long time. He just looked at me. So this was the last he and I ever said to each other about Paul's death. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those that I'm getting goosebumps now as I'm reading it again. And this is when I was listening to it on audiobook, and I was cleaning dishes in the kitchen, and I stopped like cleaning the dishes as I was reading or as I was listening to these moments, because I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna drop a dish, because the lines just there's so much charge and there's so much that's not said, and there's so much like grief that's being experienced by the father and the brother who have lost the person that they love so much. And it's just it's just grief riddled, this conversation that they're having about what they could have or should have said and didn't, and then the tragedy that ends up coming as a result of it. But I do have the very last kind of like part of the story that I have queued up. I can read it if you guys don't have anything else to add.
I just wanted to bring up the detail that I made it feel very real. I don't know. But when I finished talking to my father, is there anything else you can tell me? Finally, I said, nearly all the bones in his hand were broken. He reached over to the door, then turned back for reassurance. Are you sure that the bones in his hand were broken? I repeated, nearly all the bones in his hand were broken. In which hand, he asked. His right hand, I answered. There's... I don't know. Maybe he fought back, which is what I assume. Mm-hmm. He was fighting. But there is something about that kind of a detail, which is so specific, that I assume when I read it that that is part of the true story's part of it.
Right.
But regardless, it's something interesting that, like Mike said earlier, it's something about masculinity and purpose and doing things with a specific nature. And the fact that he fought back with his right hand because he's right-handed, I think, is important here. Mm-hmm. I think it's a nice detail that makes it feel full.
Yeah, I find it all very Hemingway-esque, I guess, because it's all so sparse, but there's so much subcontext going on. Yeah. Whether that's a masculine thing or not, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm learning to voice my feelings more, and that's part of living, but I think there's some sort of masculine code there that traditionally men don't share or say these things. And then I think he captures that so well that it's beautiful. And then I forgot, and rereading this, it reminded me the last little bit. This ties in with O'Brien and how do you tell true stories? And he talks about that in the end there, where he says, my father asked me a series of questions that suddenly made me wonder whether I ever understood my father, whom I felt closer to any other man I'd ever known. You like to tell true stories, don't you? He asked. And I answered, yes, I like to tell stories that are true. Then he asked, after you've finished your true stories sometime, why don't you make up a story and the people to go with it? Only then will you understand what happened and why. It is those we live with and love and should know who elude us. Now nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young are dead, but I still reach out to them. Mm-hmm. So this idea, like he's telling the story about storytelling and as a way to reach out to his brother and process this. And I had forgotten that, and it's not in the film at all, really. So that was an interesting moment there.
Sure.
But bring us to a close, Mike. Let's talk about those last lines.
This is the last part of the story, and my computer is going to die, so hopefully I can get through these last couple of sentences before they kick out. But maybe, Mike, if it does, you'll have it up there. So it says, of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman, and now, of course, I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. Like many fly fishermen in western Montana, where the summer days are almost Arctic in length, I often do not start fishing until the cool of the evening. Then, in the Arctic half-light of the canyon, all existence fades to a being with my soul and memories and the sounds of the big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I'm haunted by waters. And that's the way that the story ends. Oh. My gosh.
I'm haunted by waters is such a good way to end this.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Yeah, and you know, to talk about your note before, Nick, on kind of like the confidence of the writing, I think a less confident writer might end it with, under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. But that's not. He ends it with, I am haunted by waters.
Yeah.
It's jarring, and my goodness, it's a haunting last line. You can see the so much is said in, you're calling it Hemingway-esque, Mike, and that last sentence is, what, 5 words long?
Right.
And it's just, my goodness, it's so good.
Well, and it's the what he's doing, at least I think. I thought about it and then sat, right, and then thought about it again. But, like, it's something that a lot of us do for people we've lost, which is, do you stop doing the thing that reminds you of them, or do you keep doing it to remember them? Yeah. And, you know, now he's a man who, as he says, is almost too old to be doing this on his own, and yet – I'm sure every time he casts, he thinks about how his father and brother would have done it differently, mm-hmm. because that's what the whole story is about. And of course, he's haunted by those things he does. It's mm-hmm. it's just such a perfect way to explain the human condition. Yeah, I don't know. I hadn't read this before, so I was quite moved by it.
Yeah, you read that last line, you just step away and just like, damn. Like, yeah. Oh my God, like how perfect is that? So yeah. How powerful it is. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the drop the dishes moment for sure.
Yeah, exactly. I was recently motivated by my friend here, Mr. Carroll. I've been trying to get back into writing myself dusted off Stephen King's On Writing.
As you do.
And he mentions in the edition I have, I don't know if it's an all editions, but like a 20th anniversary, that when he was younger, he would pay his kids to read books for him, and he would record and pay this. This would be a perfect thing to have someone read aloud. Mm-hmm. And not just because I enjoyed the audiobook, but because it is so much in terms of like just process and narration and very simple narrative. Like, and it's short and it's tight and it's mm-hmm. there's not a wasted word almost, that I think it'd be interesting to just give to someone and say, read this for me. And just hear what they do, because it's so incredibly like thick with meaning, and yet it's a book about fishing.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I keep coming back to my description that you were saying that you like finished it and needed to process, or yeah. like you're saying that you finished it and kind of like closed the book and step away. I finished it and took about 3.5 seconds before I picked up my phone and texted my brother. And I was like, I need to talk with you guys about this book. You guys have to read this story so that I can talk with you guys about it. And I just keep coming back to that same description of this is a story about fly fishing and also about family and about fly fishing and about family. I mean, it's just they're so entwined with one another that it's so tightly wound and it's so magnificent. That's the word that I keep using to describe it. It's magnificent. And it's not as so much of because not to spoil Nick, but I know that you're going to ask the question, is this something that we could or would or would want to teach in a class? But it's less a could you and almost more of like a where and mm-hmm. how can you work something like this in there? Because I really loved it. I thought that it was incredible.
Just to reemphasize the masculine point, like it's interesting you texted your brother and your father-in-law, but mm-hmm. did you tell Catherine? What did you tell Catherine?
I did tell her too.
That's your first response. I'm going to tell the men in my life.
Well, it's funny though, because I was like, Catherine, I just finished the book. I'm texting my brother and your dad. what's kind of the way that it ended up going about? But yeah, it is interesting what kind of a cool kind of insight there. But yeah, I texted my brother and my father-in-law.
Yeah. Yeah, we really need a female perspective on this. Yeah.
Do some more female literature. Although, unfortunately, we've been choosing books that are either all women or all men recently.
We need or mice with Redwall.
That's right. That's fair. That's fair.
Of mice and men. Yeah. Well, did that one too, didn't we?
Yeah.
Anyway. It's just so biblical. I mean, just the prose or the syntax or the rhythm of that, just like it's so, I don't know, it seems otherworldly. Yeah. Not unlike the end of Gatsby.
Yeah. And
the water theme there as well.
I mean, I think.
So we beat on.
He was clever, correct in essentially doing an extended metaphor for the prodigal son, right? Yeah. Like, it adds structure to the story, which keeps the story tight. And again, I feel like these things happen, but you could also tell the story in a completely different way and it'd still be true. So the fact that he did it this way is significant. I do admire that.
Or that he had to wait that long to put the story into words. Like, I don't know how long after his brother's death did he actually write this down. He's writing this when he's 70 years old, right?
Yeah, how long did it take for him to actually craft this story? Right. Is this something that he waited until he was 68, 69 before he started to pen? Or is this something that it took him all of, I don't know, however many years in order to get this written down on the on the page, mm-hmm. because that's what it meant to him. Because, I mean, clearly you can tell how much this work means to him.
Well, and, you know, he also could have done any number of things, including, like, giving us the date. Oh, I'm as old as, like, what's the line from No Country for Old Men? I'm older now than my father ever was. We don't know. Mm-hmm. We actually have no idea where he is in the narration of his life. Like, I could tell you based on how old he was and when his brother died, because mm-hmm. it's a true story. But at the same time, the timelessness of it adds a certain amount of levity and air that makes it eternal.
Yeah.
Which I really like. It feels like if you change the characters' names a little, it could almost be like a Greek myth or something, like something about masculinity and what it means to be part of a family or a gospel narrative. Like that's what it makes it feel like it's beyond itself.
It has a parable feel to it almost. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like it avoids, you know, a clear definition in a puzzling, pleasant way. Yeah.
No. Well, thanks for listening.
Let's go fishing.
Go fishing. So obviously this year has been a little bit janky as far as releases go. That's all of our fault. We've just been busy this year. We have one more Mike Carroll short story, which we'll release. And our last book of the year is going to be Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain. It's a way for us to do something nonfiction. And Mike and I and a colleague of ours named Reynold Yoder was talking about what kind of literature people will be reading in the future. What will we teach in an English class in 20 years? And my contention is Americans write a lot of very good nonfiction and memoirs. So I think we are going to try a memoir in a way we haven't done before and crack out one of the great food writers of any generation, Anthony Bourdain. Mike, what's the Instagram handle?
Michael.C.Carroll. Thank you guys for following and for keeping us on the charts.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Required Reading is a product of Maris Podcasting and Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and co-hosted by Mike Burns and Mike Carroll. It is edited and produced by Nick Hoffman. The theme is Sands by Davis Burns. The opinions expressed are opinions of the hosts and the guests, but not of Marist School. All rights reserved. Thanks.